You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network with your host, Dan Gould. Virginia History with Rick Britton starts right now. Local historian and cartographer Rick Britton has been a good friend of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network for many years. He joins me in studio for the fourth of an exciting new series on Virginia's colorful 18th and 19th century history. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
I am very well, thank you. What have you been working on lately?
Oh my gosh, I've been really busy with cartography, and right now I've got three or four different projects in-house. I'm finishing up a series of maps for the papers of George Washington. I've got a set of six that I'm finishing up for them. I do a lot of map work for them, and it's a lot of fun. I get to do a lot of maps of Revolutionary War battles and Revolutionary War campaigns for them. They're up at the University of Virginia. It's a great group of men and women up there, the Papers of George Washington Project. And then I just got in a book project, and I'm just starting on it now. It's a set of eight maps for a military history of the Market Garden campaign in World War II. That was made famous by the movie, the book, and the movie A Bridge Too Far. It's when the paratroopers were landed behind American and were there British paratroopers? I think they were British. American and British paratroopers landed behind German lines, the idea being they would hold open a road for then the armor to drive through. And so I'm going to be drawing a lot of maps, a set of eight maps of the landings and the battles they fought around the landing fields, trying to hold open these roads in Holland. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
Cool. And yeah. I understand you draw your maps in ink.
I do.
Maps. That's amazing to me. Absolutely amazing.
I draw the maps by hand. And folks, if they're interested in seeing my samples, there are a lot of samples on my website, www.rickbritton.com, and you can see examples of my cartography, but I illustrate by hand like was done in the 18th and 19th centuries. And that's my niche. Not many people doing it this way anymore. Most all of the maps you see in books are illustrated on a computer. I think that's okay. My point of view is I think that's okay if the topic is some kind of modern history or something very new. I think computer generated stuff is appropriate for that. But, you know, if you're talking about an earlier time, the maps, I think, should be drawn the way they were at the time. And that's by hand.
Sure, exactly.
Yeah.
Those computer generated maps, when you see a tree, you think you've seen them all.
Well, you have all the trees, you know,
all the
graphic designer does is cut and paste. And so I'm just going to fill in here with trees and all the mountains and the hills look the same. And, you know, it's. For me personally, it just doesn't work. For some people, it's okay. For me, it doesn't work.
Cool. Yeah. All right. So we're back to continue our discussion about the infantry.
Yeah. It's important to spend some time.
In the Civil War, I should say.
In the Civil War,
Civil War. All right. Take it away.
Yeah. Not infantry in Iraq or Afghanistan or infantry in Somalia. It's important to spend more time on the infantry because, as I mentioned, a number of episodes ago, the infantry comprised the vast majority of the people who served in the army on both sides. 80, 85, 90% of any one army, depending on the army. And I thought we'd start off with talking about the organization. The basic unit of infantry is a company, and companies were usually brought together in a small community. This had a good outcome. The good outcome would be that brothers and fathers and sons and cousins and uncles and nephews would all get together from this one community, neighbors, people who by and large knew each other, and form this company and then go to a collection center where those companies would be put together into a larger unit. And we'll talk about that in a moment. So the good thing is you're going off to war with your friends, your family, and your neighbors. The bad outcome of that is when that company, of course, ended up in some horrific combat, and then an entire little community could get completely wiped out, as it happened very often in the Civil War. So company is the basic unit. From companies, you form battalions, and a battalion normally would be at least four companies, but maybe six or eight or even nine. But the most common infantry unit on the battlefield is the regiment, and the regiment is formed of 10 companies. So on paper, a regiment was supposed to be about 1,000 men. Very, very rarely, if ever, in Civil War combat were there 1,000-man regiments on the battlefield. Of course, they suffered casualties from combat, casualties from disease, and the diseases in the camps were just horrific, as you can imagine. And of course, they were straggling in any battle. So, for example, by the Battle of Gettysburg, the average Confederate regiment on the field was about 450 men, so less than half of what they're supposed to be on paper. The average Union regiment on the battlefield at Gettysburg was about 350 men. So notice the Confederate regiments were bigger on average. By the end of the Civil War, by 1865, the average regiment was at 150 men in the Confederate Army on the battlefield, so almost a tenth of the size of what they're supposed to be in paper.
And I have a dumb question for you, and probably
there are any dumb questions.
Probably everybody knows this, but me. But was there any form of conscription?
Yeah, conscription was used on both sides. So at first, the armies were formed of volunteers because, as everybody is aware, at the beginning of the war, there was this war fever, and both sides got whipped into a frenzy, largely by the politicians telling them that this was something that had to be done. The South and the Confederate states largely seceded to protect the rights of their citizens to own fellow human beings as property. People in the North volunteered to preserve the Union. That's what the war was started off from the Northern point of view, to protect the Union. Abraham Lincoln talked about that a lot. So initially there were all these volunteers, and then of course they get out into the field, they get into camps, and of course camp life was just tremendously boring, with drill four or five times a day, depending on what kind of regimental brigade commander you had. And then the battles, of course, were terrible. People thought in the very beginning that the war would be ended with one battle. And of course, when that didn't happen and the war started to drag on, fewer and fewer people volunteered. So both sides resorted to the draft to build these armies. And by the end of the Civil War, and we might have to edge these numbers upward, but we believe nowadays that by the end of the Civil War, North and South, about 3 million men had served in the armies, North and South. So again, 3 million out of about 32 million, one in 10. And the thing to remember about that means that almost everybody knew somebody who was in the army. So yeah, they use conscription. So you get regiments, and the regiments are commanded by their field officers. A colonel is the man in command of the regiment. He's usually got a lieutenant colonel, second in command, and a major. And sometimes if the unit was big, there might even be a junior major. Those men and the company commanders, who are captains, those are the field officers of the regiment. You take a few regiments together. You put them together. You might have as few as two. You might have as many as five, six, seven, eight, depending on the size. And you form a brigade. You take a couple of brigades and you put those together, sometimes as many as four or five. Brigades, by the way, commanded by a brigadier general. He's a brigadier because he's commanding a brigade. You put a few of those together, you get a division, commanded usually by a major general, sometimes by a brigadier general. So you get a division. You put a few divisions together, two, sometimes three or four, and you get a corps in the South commanded by a lieutenant general. And then you put a few corps together, maybe two, maybe as many as three or four, and you get an army. Sometimes in the Union Army, quite a few corps, as many as five or six, meaning that the corps are smaller, and that's the basic organization. But the basic maneuver element of infantry on the field is the regiment.
And what's the distribution of men, of soldiers, between the North and the South? Were they fairly evenly matched in terms of numbers?
In the armies?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no. By the end of the war, there are about 2 million men served in the Northern Army and about 1 million in the Southern Army. So overall, you could say that the South was outnumbered 2-1. The distribution in population was about 21 million Northerners to about 11 million Southerners. But out of those 11 million Southerners, about 4 million of those were enslaved African Americans. And of course, contrary to what a lot of people will tell you nowadays, it was illegal for the African American slaves to serve in the Confederate Army for a very good reason. If you think of the Confederacy's point of view, the Confederacy is built on the inequality of races. And if you say all of a sudden that, yes, we can put African Americans in the field, then you're attacking the very basis of your culture and the basis of your civilization. So it was illegal. There were lots of African Americans, slaves, that accompanied the Confederate armies. And we'll talk about this in a later episode. At the very end of the war, there actually were some African American Confederate soldiers. At the very end of the war, a very few, but by and large, all the African Americans with the Confederate Army were either wagoners, teamsters, cooks, body servants, manservants. So they weren't there as soldiers. They were there as extras, people helping with the army. Now, that helped quite a bit.
Now, but there were African Americans serving in the North.
Right, and we think as many as 200,000 by the end of the war. Yeah, once the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect on the first day of 1863, and they started conscripting African Americans in the North.
And were these Northern African Americans, or were these African Americans that had moved up from the South, tried to escape their bondage and move?
That's a great question, Dan, and the answer is all of the above.
Some of each.
A mixture of everything. African Americans from the North and African Americans who had run away, escaped slaves.
Yes.
So that's pretty fascinating. So that's the basic organization. Thanks for asking those great questions. That's the basic organization of infantry, and then in movement and in combat, I wanted to talk about the different formations. I mentioned a few of them, I think, in our last episode when we were talking about massed formations. But the basic formation of an infantry regiment in battle is the line of battle, or a battle line, and it's in two ranks, the front rank and the rear rank. So all of the companies are aligned in two ranks. They're dressed on the center where the color company is and the color guard is. So as they move forward or as they withdraw in battle and they take casualties, they're closing up onto the center and, of course, getting smaller and smaller. But what they're doing is they're closing up on the colors, which are right near the center of the regiment. So that's the standard line of infantry in battle, the battle line, two ranks. There's lots of different ways to fire a unit. Sometimes they would fire all at once. You would do that fairly seldom because that meant that everybody was unloaded all at once. So that's generally in a battle not a good idea, unless the enemy happens to be running away from you and you feel pretty safe to fire everybody at once. It took an infantryman, a really experienced infantryman, could load and fire three times in a minute. Now, keep in mind that there's 20 to 40 cartridges in that cartridge box. You divide that by three, and you realize really quickly that if he does that for a few number of minutes, he's out of ammunition. So generally, you don't want to do that, and you want to control the rate of fire so your men don't run out of ammunition too quickly and then have to be resupplied, or even worse yet, pulled out of the line of battle because they've got no ammunition. So that's the battle line. Yep.
And what's the rank of a line commander? The person who commands the line, who gives the orders to fire, what would his rank be in the?
Well, the colonel is commanding the regiment, uh-huh. and the colonels trained their regiments so that they would give the commands, all the commands, and then they're echoed by the other field commanders. So can everybody in a regiment, let's say a regiment of 500 men, can everybody hear the colonel? Yeah, if no other regiments are firing, if there are no other cannon, if there are no cannon nearby and nobody else is yelling and screaming, which means fairly seldom. So the colonel is yelling out the commands and everybody else is, all of the other officers are repeating the commands. So generally he would give a command, and you give a command that it's broken into a couple of parts. And the first part advises everybody that there's a command coming. And so the rest of the field officers have to listen closely. Then the colonel gives the second part of the command, which is the command of execution. And all of the field officers repeat the command of execution. It's very important for all those men to repeat the command. So that's how the information got down to the ranks.
And that must be very difficult under battle conditions.
It is very difficult.
To get those messages through.
It is very difficult, but everybody, you know, everybody in a line of battle, hopefully in a good regiment, is interested in doing their job, and they're interested in surviving that battle. And in a good regiment, they like to believe that their colonel has their best interests, the interest of preserving the regiment and having the regiment do the best possible job in a battle that it can. So usually the men are eager to hear the commands and perform the commands. But that, of course, also assumes something that's fairly big. And the big assumption, the elephant in the room there, is that these guys have good morale. Once that morale is broken, then all of that that I just mentioned, all of that kind of falls apart.
So it's not really like in Hollywood where the colonel yells fire at will and then just mayhem breaks out.
Sometimes it is. And sometimes you do fire at will, and the men generally liked that command. The only problem is what I told you about earlier. They have a limited amount of ammunition. And if they're firing at will, and let's say they're firing two rounds a minute, well, within 15, 20 minutes, they're out of ammunition. And, you know, the big question on everybody's mind when you're out of ammunition is, what do we do now? And there are not a lot of really good answers. Do we stay here and just take the enemy fire without returning it? Do we pull out of the line of battle and create a hole here because we can't return the fire? Or even worse yet, what some people might really dread really badly is, since we're out of ammunition, are we going to get the order to fix bayonets and charge the enemy without ammunition? And that happened a number of times. So nobody is really interested. You know, the guys want to put out as much fire as possible. But in the back of the commanding officer's mind is, you know, how much more ammunition do these guys have? How long can we keep this up? So, yeah, sometimes they do get the order, fire at will, but then the commander's going to break in after a couple of minutes to slow that firing down.
Wow. Fascinating, as always, Rick. Fascinating. So you'll be back to talk to us again in 2 weeks, October 23rd. You'll be returning, and what are we going to? We're going to carry on with the infantry.
We'll probably stay. I know people are kind of bored with the infantry, perhaps, but we'll stay.
I'm not.
Fantastic. So we'll stay with the infantry a little bit more, and then we'll move on to the cavalry and the artillery.
That's excellent. We'll see you then.
All right. Thanks.
Join us each second and fourth Sunday for Virginia History with Rick Britton. For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.